Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. It's Lockie here and I have exceptional news for you all. Not only do we have a superb and extremely interesting guest on the podcast today, but also the lovely Charlotte White is taking time out from her hectic foodie festival to join us and do some restoration period stuff. How are you, Charlie?
I'm all right. Thank you, Lockie. It's nice not to be on the road for a day. It's nice to be in my comfort zone of the 17th century.
Well, you say that, but your comfort zone does seem to be on the road, because last time I saw you, you were an absolute rock star in Oxford at the Foodies Festival, and we were jamming out massively to other rock stars as well. But you did look absolutely superb out there.
Thank you very much. It's lovely being a traveling showgirl chef, but my goodness, have I got a treat, a delicious treat for you all today. Today, we're going to be joined by Adam Nightingale, who's an author and a performer specializing in history's villains and their legends. You'll find him at the National Civil War Centre in Newark and on stage performing alongside his brother Mark in the 17th Century Show, as well as in the Fighting Nightingales, a band who perform comedic material with a historical slant. I mean, how much does this sound up our street? He's recorded his own podcast series, The 17th Century Tales, featuring the dashing Cavalier General, Prince Rupert of the Rhine. So I simply had to book him for History Hack. Hello, Adam.
Hello. Nice to be here.
We're so glad to have you joining us today. So we met a couple of weekends ago, didn't we, at the Civil War Centre.
Yeah.
And you were surrounded by boxes at the time.
Mountains and mountains of cardboard boxes. Yeah.
What was going on?
Does that need explanation?
Yeah, of course.
It was our summer activity called Playham, which actually had nothing to do with the Civil War. It's a philosophy of free play where you just fill the room full of literally probably 1,000 cardboard boxes and cardboard tubes and, you know, little bits and bobs. And the idea is you can make what you want. You can add to or take away from anything that someone's previously made, and you can, but you can't stick anything together, and you can't, you know. So it was a sort of brainchild of our, you know, the learning team I worked for, you know, specifically a lady called Donna Hall and Denise Greeny, and it was a two-edged sword. It was a fantastic, absolutely fantastic thing to observe kids being very creative. There were supposed to be no rules, but then rules got imposed, like, please don't knock down that massive mountain of cardboard boxes. I've taken an hour to put back together again. Take them out like Jenga pieces and don't destroy cardboard boxes. But other than that, do what you like. So it was a sort of fantastic, very successful summer activity that was absolutely exhausting to reset. But it was good. And that's where we met, in a room full of cardboard boxes. It's not a warehouse.
It was fantastic. You say there was no Civil War slant, but I definitely saw several forts being built and castles.
Yes, they were. I couldn't verify like what era the forts were from. I couldn't hand on heart say they were like Civil War forts or sconces. Amazing. Or what have you. But yeah.
Well, if anyone would know, it would be you. So let's start at the beginning of Prince Rupert's life. It starts in quite a dramatic fashion, doesn't it?
Yeah, and sort of carries on in that vein, really. You know, yeah, he's the son of German royalty, so and English royalty. So he's the son of Prince Frederick V, the Elector of the Palatine, a German, very powerful Protestant German prince. His mother is Elizabeth, the sister of Charles I, daughter of James I. And he's allowed 1 year of enjoying the luxury of living the life of a royal. He's not heir to the throne. I think he's like third or fourth child. And then his father's embroiled in what turns out to be, his father effectively starts what turns out to be the 30 Years' War. So, which is very, very complicated. I'll try and condense it, which essentially means that the Holy Roman Emperor, Habsburg Emperor, makes himself King of Bohemia, which alienates a lot of the Protestants. He's a Catholic. So the Protestant princes band together and they persuade Frederick to elect himself King of Bohemia. So you can't have two kings of Bohemia. So it sparks a war. Frederick, Rupert's father, basically, there's a battle called the Battle of the White Mountain, which he's not even at, actually. He doesn't arrive at his own battle on time. His army's annihilated in 1 hour. And then you know, the Habsburg emperor, I think it was like Ferdinand II, basically orders him out of his kingdom. It doesn't physically punish him, but he kicks him out of his kingdom. And Rupert and his parents end up in The Hague as kind of exiled, penniless by royal standards, still rich by our standards, exiled royals. And then this incredible, brutal war that lasts three decades, you know, sort of erupts and consumes him, consumes his early life, really, you know, and so he's born with a very rigid mistrustful hatred of Catholics and this sort of sense that something's been taken away from him and that he needs to get it back. And that sort of dogs him all his life, really, you know.
Gosh.
I'm kind of right. Here's where I show my massive ignorance of all of this, because I mean I'm aware of certainly defenestrations around this time, isn't there? Yeah. There's that sort of stuff going on, but broadly this falls between kind of the period when Henry VIII is having everyone killed and Germany is unified for me. So I'm a little
I should have said when he was born in like 1619. This all sort of, and this kicks off I think in 1620. So it's, you know, it's the Stuarts are on the throne, James I on the throne. You know, he's obviously Prince Rupert's uncle. And then, you know, you have this European war that we don't talk a lot about in England. It's not, I mean, and it is possibly, if you look at the population at the time, probably the most brutal land war Europe ever suffered. I think the population of Germany was absolutely sort, and it could have been a quick war had not Sweden got involved. And then Sweden were a massive military power and they had this incredible king, Gustavus Adolphus, who's considered one of the authentic military geniuses of the era. And then it just becomes this thing that escalates and escalates and escalates and kills millions of people and is sort of noted particularly for its brutality and the kind of horror it inflicted on the civilian population. Does that sort of...
Yeah, no, it does. So, I mean, right. So when I got invited to come onto this podcast and help host it, I mean, right, Prince Rupert. Okay, yeah. So he's got to be some flouncing royal fop, hasn't he? I think he's Prince Rupert, what a name. Turns up in England, sort of is there around the Civil War. That's not accurate, though, is it? He's got some military experience before then. So
no. There was nothing flouncing about him to start with. I mean, and the name Rupert has been, I guess it's been a little bit feminized over the decades. And back then, not so much. You know, the name Rupert, you know, I mean, he was the most famous Rupert of the 17th century. And it was synonymous with a certain type of soldiering, extreme physical toughness.
It's a cuddly bear with funny trousers.
Yeah. And this is a tall, long haired. I mean, he was over 6 foot by the time he was 15. By the time he was 15, he killed people in war. And this was a tall, very well dressed, but sort of, you know, posh, but phenomenally violent, aggressive man. You know, and he was sort of plunged into the war at his mother's behest. You know, his father, and his education was very military. I mean, he had the sort of standard royal education, private tutors, and he was very good. This gets overshadowed by his military achievements, but he's very, very good at he's a bit of a polymath, so he's phenomenal at languages, very good at science. I think he was good at mathematics, and obviously he excelled at the martial arts. You know, he's a phenomenal sword fighter, very, very good shot with a pistol, and an outstanding horseman. So by the time he's 13, his mother, or his father dies, but that was an important bit of information I forgot. His father dies of a fever when he's about sort of 11 or 12. And by 13, his mother, if you got sort of a military version of a pushy stage mother, his mother Elizabeth is that. And she wants her children to go into the military. So he's sort of given over to his uncle, who's the Prince of Orange, to fight. And he's champing at the bit to fight. He wants to. And his uncle's trying to keep him out of the war. And he's at the Siege of Rheinberg, and he's not allowed to fight. And then there's another siege, the Siege of Breda in the Spanish Netherlands. And he sort of, kind of, on his own recognizance, allies himself to a band of English mercenaries because, you know, there's not an awful lot going on militarily in England at the time. And so a lot of aristocrats and gentlemen of fortune went over to Europe and fought in this war just for money. And so he's got this little kind of almost like Dirty Dozen-esque band of sort of English soldiers of fortune. And he just aligns himself with them. And I don't think his uncle knew about this. He decides he's going to be part of the Forlorn Hope. which, I mean, you'll know what a forlorn hope is, but it's essentially once you blast a hole in the castle wall, you need some people to go in first. And they're almost likely certainly going to die or just get horribly injured. And it's volunteers only. And obviously the upshot of doing that is if you're the first through the breach, you survive, you're a hero and you're likely to get promoted. And Rupert just, I mean, I think he's 13 when he does this. He sort of goes in with a forlorn hope. And, you know, once they're, you know, and obviously the other side of the wars is going to be sort of lines of musketeers, maybe a cannon ready just to blow your head off. And he sails through it, missing all the musket balls, cannon balls, guys next to him are getting like shot, atomized, crippled. And he does a bit of damage and sort of begins to earn this reputation, not only being a ferocious soldier, but of being indestructible, of seeking the kind of basically the hornet's nest of a battle and coming out of it. Even if he loses, even if his sort of side is decimated without receiving a scratch on him. And that's the sort of beginning of this reputation as a teenage soldier that builds throughout the 30 Years' War and that he brings to England with him as a sort of cavalier fighting for his uncle, Charles I.
Gosh. And, you know, being that kind of indestructible, unshoot-downable kind of force, when you are... Yeah, he was. Am I right to say he was about 6'4"?
Yes, he was about six feet four. Yeah,
it's not at that time.
No,
you know. That's tall now.
So he stood out and sat on a horse as well. You know, so he's like kind of, I don't know how that would make him at 15 foot tall or something on horseback.
Good God! And as for his pedigree, I mean, we've touched on a few members of his family here, and this is where you kind of when you know about the Stuarts, this can sometimes feel like you're sort of trying to explain 30 years of EastEnders to people. But his grandfather is James the First. I'm getting confused. Yeah. And his mother is sister to Charles I.
Yeah.
And his uncle is Prince of Orange in Holland.
And Charles I.
Exactly. So he's got the royal family at this time is spread across this part of Europe. Like,
but also his cousins are the future sort of Charles II and James the First. No, James the Second.
You see, now you're doing it.
And they're kids at the moment. They're like little children.
Amazing. Gosh. Yeah. So we're going to go a bit rogue.
Yeah.
And we're not going to talk about Rupert's life from start to finish. We're not going along the chronological route here. We're gonna go to the Civil War now. What's always hilariously called the English Civil War. We're not going to go from start to finish, but instead we're going to talk about his successful campaigns and his perhaps not so successful ones. So I want to start with the good stuff. What did Prince Rupert get right when he comes over?
Well, if I can just travel back just to explain why he's in the Civil War. It's because he gets taken prisoner at a battle called the Battle of Vlotho. And he's a prisoner for 3 years in an Austrian castle. And it's Charles I really that negotiates his release. So in the sort of preliminary lead up to the Civil War, he wants his best soldiers and he knows his nephew's reputation. And they've met a couple of times and he loves his nephew. And so he negotiates the release. And so Rupert comes over and they want to get rid of him, actually. They don't want him there in Linz Castle because people are constantly trying to fight their way to rescue him because obviously he's a valuable commander. And so his negotiation is released on the understanding that he gives his word that he's not going to fight against the Holy Roman Emperor. And he gives his word and he keeps it for the rest of his life. Mm. Never fights against them, despite many, many temptations to you later. And then comes over And for the first half of the Civil War, he's probably like the best soldier in any battlefield. And the thing that he brought to the table were these radical cavalry tactics that he didn't invent. They were Gustavus Adolphus's, but he kind of refined and the sort of the way a cavalry charge would work prior to Gustavus Adolphus is you would approach in a line of horses with your pistols drawn, fire your pistols at a distance, and then maybe follow it up with a sort of a more spirited charge with horses. And he just thought, well, that just takes the impact out of the cavalry charge. So we'll charge headlong in. I'll be at the front, obviously, because I'm Prince Rupert. And in a sort of almost like a triangular wedge, we'll crash into our enemies. Then we'll fire our pistols at point blank range and then go to work with our swords. And obviously, you know, the risk is higher, but the kind of reward is greater in terms of carnage wreaked on your enemies. And he does this for the first time in outside of Worcester, at a place called Powick Bridge. And it's a fight. It's called the Battle of Powick Bridge, but it's a glorified skirmish that lasted a quarter of an hour. And I think he was defending the rear guard of a cavalier train, train of horses, obviously. And I think he's protecting like some money or like some kind of mold that made money, the mint. And he just sort of launches this attack at the cavaliers, and they scatter. They don't know what's hit them. And all of a sudden, you know, this sort of ripples of this soldier's kind of effective cavalry tactics, you know, sort of go throughout, you know, the Roundheads, and they're afraid of him. Every time he's on a battle, it's a cause for concern. And he follows that up with an incredible cavalry charge at the first big battle, the official battle, of the Civil War, Edge Hill, with this incredible cavalry charge where he kind of takes out the Roundhead cavalry. And then we're going to slightly dip into the sort of things he did wrong here, because what he does is he plows through the enemy, and then his horses carry on going. And, you know, and he loses control of his men. They ride for miles into the next field, then they stop. Then they go back, then they spot a baggage train, then they loot that, then they go back to the battle, assuming that they've won, and not realizing that the Roundhead infantry have done quite a good job in the King's colours have been captured. And so he kind of retrieves the King's colours, and then the battle comes to an end, and it's basically a draw. You know, both sides in Edge Hill have killed pretty much exactly the same amount of people. They both claim victory. And you know, but it doesn't hurt his reputation, because he's done his bit, even though he's kind of he takes Bristol. You know, he's very good at taking cities. You know, he takes Bristol. He's fighting his way into Bristol, and his horse gets this is horrible if you like animals. His horse gets shot through the eyeball, and he carries on fighting his way to Bristol on foot. And then they bring him another horse, and he takes Bristol. His big thing. I mean, I work in Newark, so we have to sort of highlight this, but it is seen by many military historians as the kind of apex of his achievement. Newark, which was the only royalist town in the East Midlands, and very important because of where it lay on the North Road and the Great and the Old Foss Way, these two roads that connected the country, was surrounded by in 1644 an army of about 6,000. And he makes this incredible dash from Chester to Newark, barely letting his army sleep, with a sort of modestly sized force, accumulating riders as he goes, stopping off on loyal towns, manages to sort of get to the top of the only hill in Newark. And the strange thing is, like the leader of the besieging forces, a man called Sir John Meldrum, knew he was coming, but didn't put lookouts on the hill, because he didn't think he could get there quick enough from Chester. So he just makes this fatal error. Rupert turns up and then plows into them, and then sort of demolishes, you know, the besieging army. And then he's just this phenomenally magnanimous victor, because he disarms them of their sort of firearms and pikes, gives these weapons to the defenders of Newark, but allows the officers to keep their swords, keep their colours, and leave with their honour intact. And there's a report, this is contradicted by the governess of Nottingham, who said he didn't do this, but yeah, there are reports of him slapping soldiers with the flat of his sword who were seen looting prisoners, and just like rebuking them and things like that. So that's Rupert at his best in a nutshell. These are the things that he did. Very aggressive, you know, just drove his men, had these incredible cavalry tactics, and could be very, very honourable and magnanimous in victory. So, but if he was just that, he wouldn't be as interesting.
That charge down from Chester, this was a matter of only a few days, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know why I've got in my head that it was either 4 or 8 days.
It was about nine. I think it was 9 days.
There you go. Yeah. So it was very quick. And that he had people going out in front of his troops, yeah, and cutting down the hedgerows so that when they came by, they could just plow through in this straight line.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's new to me.
That was our tour guide in Newark. That's why you always do the walking tour with an expert guide.
Yeah. but also, I mean, he marched his soldiers through the night, and there's a wonderful, we've got it at the museum. There's this wonderful pamphlet. It's an anonymous officer who just gives a first-hand account of Rupert fighting. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he had an army of 6,000. I think he arrived on top of Beacon Hill with 400 men, and just couldn't be bothered to wait for the rest of them. So he thought, well, let's just attack them now, see what happens. And he did a version in miniature of what he did at Edge Hill. He got separated from his own soldiers in the cavalry charge. And they have this incredible description of three roundhead cavalrymen converging on him. And this is a point, many points where he came within a hair's breadth of getting killed. And he kills one himself. He runs him through with his sword, we're told in this pamphlet. And then he commanded phenomenal loyalty in the soldiers underneath him. And so there were two soldiers, an Irish soldier called O'Brien, and a Frenchman that pops up again in his life, I think called Monsieur Mortain or something like that. And Monsieur Mortain shoots the second cavalier out of his saddle. And then this is very ambiguously worded, but the third roundhead gets behind him and he's about to kind of grab Prince Rupert by the cloak and pull him off his horse. And then it said this soldier O'Brien comes up with a sword drawn and almost chops the man's hand off, which you can sort of, if we're with schools, I let them decide that means that he missed his hand by a hair's whisker, or if he almost chopped his hand off, he hacked through the wrist and the man's hand would have been swinging from a bit of flesh like a door hinge, which is the version I prefer. But either way, he survives when he should have died. He takes these incredible risks and they pay off up to this point in the war.
Do you know, it's starting to sound like a combination of Sharp, yeah. Lord Flashheart,
yeah.
And I don't know, Conan or something like that.
I'll go with Conan. I think he's weirdly he's more like Conan. He wasn't like a massive hedonist like Flashman. And obviously he was posh, Conan's not posh, but Conan, there was a grimness to Conan, a humorlessness and a love of the fight. Despised physical weakness, would call out anybody he thought was an idiot apart from the king, you know, and that was his one sort of the one line he didn't want to cross, you know. Yeah, so I think he's like call it posh Conan.
With a better
and he's Germanic
haircut.
As well, you know. Yeah, posh Conan.
Okay, so he's an absolute bally hero. where could it possibly go wrong?
For the next 2 years, he does everything wrong, more or less. The next big event in his life is the Battle of Master Moor. So I guess drunk on victory, he goes from, I think there's a few things he does in between, but he goes from his victory at Newark, and then his next significant order from the king is to go and relieve the siege of York. Now York is a vital part of the kingdom for the king, because a lot of his support is in the north of England, and if York falls, the north falls. And so he goes up there with his army, chases the roundheads away from York quite easily, but then an army is sort of gathering 6 miles away from York, and it's a coalition of Scots Presbyterian soldiers who've entered the war. And the English, and present among them is Oliver Cromwell, who he's never fought. This is the first time he'll fight Oliver Cromwell, and Sir Thomas Fairfax. You know, these rising stars in the army's 10,000 stronger than Prince Rupert. Rupert's got, I think, 18,000 men. They've got 28,000. And the problem with Rupert is he didn't play well with others. And so he has to share the command with a man called William Cavendish, who, by all accounts and purposes, was a lovely man. Incredibly rich, raised his own army, wasn't an experienced soldier, and he deferred all of his military decisions to a man called James King, who Prince Rupert hated, you know, because he felt that they fought together in the 30 Years' War in a battle called Vlotho, which resulted in Prince Rupert's capture. And Rupert felt that, you know, King had fled the battlefield and left him to be captured. And so these guys hate each other. Rupert wants to launch a quick, decisive attack, but the problem with the soldiers in York is that they're all drunk. You know, they've been celebrating the relief of York. They're drunk. They turn up late to the rendezvous, hungover. So half the army is hungover. Rupert assumes that he's in command. William Cavendish assumes he's in command. He's quite happy to defer to Rupert if Rupert's not rude to him, but Rupert is rude to him. And also, he has this really ambiguously worded letter. You have to, I haven't got it to read, but if you read the letter from the king to Rupert, it makes no sense. You don't know what he's asking Rupert to do. I can't even sort of condense it and paraphrase it. But so Rupert tries to make sense of this ridiculously convoluted set of orders from the king. and then turns up to fight this battle. And all of this, you know, you could argue that, you know, the other people are incompetent, but then Rupert displays massive incompetence by just sort of relaxing. you know, it's about sort of about 5-6 o'clock. He relaxes. He sort of takes a lot of his guards off guard. There's a roundhead army like on the other side of this field. And his assumption is, well, no one's going to attack us until the morning. And then, as if nature's sort of ringing the bell, there's this massive thunderstorm. And then the roundheads attack, take Rupert completely by surprise. I mean, the Cavaliers, they do some stuff, you know, kind of reasonably well on the battlefield, but ultimately they're overwhelmed. Rupert's cavalry clashes with Cromwell's cavalry for the first time, and Rupert's cavalry is destroyed. Rupert's unhorsed. He's not present on the battlefield to kind of give any kind of coherent instructions. And in the space of 2 hours, his army is scattered and annihilated, and 4,000 of his soldiers are dead. And he's scrabbling around in Beanfield trying to find his horse and get away. And I suppose we look at the other thing Rupert did or was reputed to have done. He did massacre people from time to time. So sort of later on in the war.
Just from time to time.
Say from time to time because like everyone massacred people. Yeah, it was a tiny massacre. Other people massacred, I would say Cromwell massacred more people, but Rupert's reputation was as a butcher. Unfairly, purely because he'd learnt his trade in the 30 Years' War, and that was typified by massacres. And so he was wrongly, I think he did set Birmingham on fire, and he was wrongly sort of, you know, I think he was wrongly accused in pamphlet form of massacring the civilian population. But everyone agrees that he visited sort of horrible retribution on Leicester. He hated Leicester for reasons we can go into if you want to. But he attacked Leicester in the latter stages of the Civil War and massacred a lot of civilians. And even sort of Charles Spencer, who's Prince Rupert's biggest fanboy. Even he in his book on Rupert has to admit, yeah, he probably went a little bit too far there and like killed, you know, I mean, like killed nuns and things like that, you know. So, yeah, so he was prone to being occasionally very, very ruthless.
I think we do need to just in case we have any listeners in Leicester.
Yeah.
Why did he hate Leicester?
Well, he hated Leicester for a couple of reasons. When he first arrived in England, he was trying to find the king, which was a little bit difficult. So he arrived in Tynemouth. Probably wasn't in a very good mood because his horse threw him and he dislocated his shoulder, you know, and then had it popped back in by his brother. So that's how tough he was. Rode down to Nottingham, where the king had obviously raised his standard. The king wasn't there. The king was supposed to be in Leicester, but wasn't in the town. He was in an abbey. And so something a little bit weird. And at some point, he writes a letter to Leicester demanding that they stump up money to help the war effort and threatens them. And then they go and, not surprisingly, they go and throw in with Parliament. And so there's all these reasons. Like he felt that they betrayed the king. You know, they turned on him. They hadn't done what he ordered them to. So when he gets the chance, I mean, I don't know what was going in his head, if this was what fueled it, or just Leicester was the nearest, you know, because the reason for attacking Leicester was to draw the besieging army that was surrounding Oxford in the last stage of war, to draw it away from Oxford so that the king could get away. And he chooses Leicester, and he destroy, you know, I mean, what he does is despicable in Leicester, and if you're a Rupert, if you're a fan of Rupert like mine, it's the one unambiguous black mark against him that he massacres people, and you know, and the best you can say is everyone was massacring people, which is like not really a defense, you know, it's a historically contextual, you know, but you know, nowadays it's, you know, a massacre is a massacre, isn't it? I guess
it's very hard to look at these times, especially. War, and especially with this early modern kind of warfare, isn't sort of the kind of later that there were these awful things that would happen, just almost cleaning up after a big battle, that sort of approach. Like, right, you guys lost.
Everyone was guilty of it, you know. Both sides did it, you know, and Rupert did it, but in his defense, not as much as he was credited of doing. He didn't really even do it in the 30 Years' War, when there was a real license to do it then. You know, there's no real.
It's awful because when you sort of you want to kind of justify it. There's no justification for it. But going back just one phase, is Leicester in the aftermath of Marston Moor? Just in terms of
it is. It is after Marston Moor. But the weird thing about Marston Moor is you think that this is when Rupert's halo really starts to slip and he starts to. And the fact that he's insulted and alienated so many people at the first half of the war, when he's essentially the sort of apex soldier, comes back to haunt him, you know. And so he just starts. He doesn't lose all the time, but he has this sort of succession of losses and disgraces, and his enemies sort of converge on him and kind of destroy him effectively politically. But yeah, it's definitely after Marston Moor. But bizarrely, after Marston Moor, he's given command of the whole army. Up to that point, he's command of the cavalry, the horse, and he's given overall command, you know. But I suppose the biggest thing that befalls him is the big falling out of the king, because the king effectively breaks faith with him. And there's a, I mean, do you want me to go into that or?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because and that's really the kind of the fall of Rupert at this phase in his life. Because so long as he's winning, he's not always listened to. That's the thing. I mean, there's a school of thought that he could have ended the civil war at the beginning, because after Edge Hill, he recommends to the king an immediate sort of march on London, and the king dithers, and then you know London sort of galvanizes its defenses, and by the time he comes round to Rupert's point of view, it's too late. London's properly defended by the militia. And he had that all the way through his career. People didn't listen to him. And his big enemy was a man called George Digby, who was an advisor to the king, a favourite of the king's wife, Queen Henrietta Maria. And him and Rupert absolutely despised each other. And Rupert's downfall really was he'd taken Bristol at the beginning of the Civil War. And then he sort of ordered to defend Bristol, because at this point, all of the towns and ports that are loyal to the king after the Battle of Naseby, Naseby is the big defeat. Sorry, we completely missed Naseby out. The king's forces after Marston Moor, you have the follow-up Battle of Naseby, where this time Rupert and the king on the battlefield are fighting the new model army. So the army's reorganized after Marston Moor and given, Thomas Fairfax and Oliver Cromwell given complete control over how they organise, recruit and train and pay the army. And so you have this Puritan, drilled, disciplined army. And Prince Rupert, to give him credit, he doesn't want to fight them initially. And he's overruled, he's countermanded by the king. He's got Digby whispering in his ear going, no, fight them, defeat them quickly. And the army's annihilated, and the king can't put another army in the field at this point. So all he's got left are hopes for a miracle, because he's the divinely anointed king of England, and he can expect that from his own point of view. And towns and garrisons that are kind of loyal to the king, and they're just getting snuffed out after Naseby one by one. They're falling, and the only port available to the king is Bristol. So Rupert's given the port to defend, but he's taken Bristol, and he knows that the defences are weak. And also the plague breaks out in Bristol. So his soldiers, there's a problem that his soldiers are going to die of the plague. So he's given this horrible, horrible sort of choice where he's offered terms of surrender by Thomas Fairfax. And the terms of surrender are pretty much exactly the ones he offered his enemies at the Siege of Newark. It's like, you can leave with your army, we'll take your firearms, you can keep your swords, you can keep your honour, and we will live to fight another day. So to him, it's a pragmatic decision. We surrender Bristol to live to fight another day, because if we stay here, we're going to get massacred or we'll die of the plague. And so he leaves. But at this point, his enemies have been working on the king, and they convince the king that Rupert has surrendered it out of cowardice. And that's kind of hard to believe. So they say, well, no, he took a bribe of I'm not sure if it was 800 or 8,000 gold coins. So he's betrayed you. And the king believes it. And when Rupert sort of meets the king in Oxford, he's placed under house arrest, and he's like kind of a little bit bemused about this. And then Digby whisks the king away. And Prince Rupert, being Prince Rupert, he just decides, well, I don't want to be under house arrest, and no one stops him. So he sort of leaves Oxford looking for the king for a reckoning, because the king orders him sort of out of the country. He wants to banish him. And the king and Rupert kind of follows the king to Newark. He's literally fighting his way across the East Midlands for a reckoning with the king. And so the king's found in Newark, and Rupert turns up completely uninvited with 120 armed men. This is the weird bit if you live in Newark, marches into the governor's house where the king's staying, which until a few months ago was a Greggs. It was just like Tudor building. It was a Greggs sandwich shop. And so whenever we did tours with schools, it was a real bit of kind of learning hackery, because always make it out like we said this joke the first time. Go, hey, look, it's a great. It's like the king, you know, the interrupt the king eating his sausage roll and beans and things like that. But it's not a Greggs anymore, which is a shame. But he marches into this building, and they have this stand up blazing. Right, he abandons all protocol. He hasn't washed. He hasn't changed his clothing, and he walks. He interrupts the king while he's eating, and demands a reckoning. Demands that he be put on trial for court martial. And he's acquitted. He's acquitted of, you know, treachery and cowardice. He's found guilty of having bad judgment as a commander, which he doesn't like. He's not satisfied with that, and he's willing to let things lie. But then the king sacks the governor of Newark, which is one of Rupert's best friends and close allies. So that prompts another trip to Greg's, another kind of marching into the building, another interruption of the king to demand why his friend's been sacked, and he's brought his sort of henchmen with him, and I'm not even sure Digby's there at this time. Digby's followers are there. And swords are drawn in the king's presence. There's almost this massive carve-up in the presence of the king. And then the king loses his temper, and cooler heads prevail. And Rupert sort of backs off a little bit and then leaves. He comes in with 120 people. And this says a lot about Rupert. Leaves with 300. and then is sort of forgiven by the king. They reconcile properly later on. But that's effectively the end of his military career. You know, he's present at Oxford when Oxford surrenders. And then he has to leave the country. You know, everyone wants him gone out of the country, and he leaves the country, and that's the end of the Civil War. And he never sees the king again. Obviously, we know what happens to the king, and, you know, and that was heartbreaking for him to not be in England and learn later on that the king has been beheaded, you know. So that's the negative dark side of Rupert.
He's clearly far from perfect. His personality and his performance in the military, does his personality give him pros and cons as a leader of men?
Yeah, definitely. He I think he led from the front, which is problematic. His men loved him. I think that's important to say. His men were fanatically devoted to him. I think if you were below him and you were a military person, he was the best person you could serve. And wherever he went in his subsequent adventures after the civil wars, his men followed him. And sadly, you know, they kind of one by one died and were killed or were drowned in various adventures he went on. But they were all fanatically anyone. I think it was because he was young as well, and he knew his trade. He there was no diplomacy in him. He wasn't a politician. And if he thought someone was an idiot, he would tell them. he didn't have sort of Cromwell's ability to stand back and coordinate battle, which was a fault. So he had to be sort of front and center of the fighting, which is problematic if you're a general, you know. So it worked up to a point, but then he could be outthought, not normally outfought. Cromwell outfought him, and he could never maintain the discipline of his army at crucial moments. Like he on more than one occasion at Naseby. I mean, what he did at Naseby, even though he lost the battle, was extraordinary, because he launched a successful cavalry charge uphill, and sort of decimated, I think it was the right wing of the New Model Army's cavalry, and then did his normal thing of rode around the back of the battlefield, looted the baggage train, assumed that there were no more cavalry to be dealt with, and there were reserves held that were kind of released into the battle while he was off the battlefield. And then when he came back, it was even worse than Edge Hill, because the army was in complete disarray and the king came within a hair's whisker of being captured himself. So those were his faults, and a sort of ruthlessness as well when it suited him. I don't know if phlegmatic's the right word, but depending on what side of the bed he got out of, he could be very magnanimous, or he could kill you where you stood, you know, if it was expedient for him to do so, you know.
Gosh, I mean, just to backtrack in you know, his performance in the war and when things start going wrong for him after Marston Moor, we've got to address the elephant or the standard poodle in the room. Could the sort of his downfall, if we're going to call it that, be attributed to the loss of a talisman, a brave, good boy at Marston Moor?
So if you're a Puritan pamphlet writer, definitely. You're talking about Boy the Dog you know, the sort of Civil War wonder hound, you know. And his relationship with Boy, he got Boy as a present. Boy was, no one quite really knows what Boy was. Boy was a dog, obviously, we know that, but he was half poodle. Again, like Rupert, is that what you were saying earlier about Rupert not being particularly macho name? neither poodles aren't considered like up there with Rottweilers and like pit bulls, you know, as the great attack dogs of history. But this one was, I mean, this was a hunting poodle. That was crossbred with some kind of fighting dog. We don't know what, probably a mastiff. So although he might have been very prettified, we know that he could rip the throat out of a stag, because in between battles, when Rupert wants to like relax from fighting, he'd go out and kill an animal. You know, so he'd go out and like shoot a stag, and he deliberately wing the stag and then unleash Boy to take, you know, And I think wherever he was, he took. I don't think the dog participated. I mean, there's pictures that show it, the dog fighting in battles. I'm not sure that's accurate. I'm not sure the dog ever participated in a battle. But where, but you know, if you couldn't pick Rupert out in a crowd because he was like a giant, you know, if you look for an enormous, foppish looking dog alongside him, you know who he was. And because he never lost in the Civil War up to, you know, like the middle of the fighting, and because he seemed to constantly be in the center of the fiercest parts of the fighting and never get injured. In fact, the only injury he received in the Civil War was a grazed hand at Newark when a pistol ball rips his glove and just sort of kind of glances off his hand. That's it. And so there was a very, very famous pamphlet written called Observations on Prince Rupert's White Dog Called Boy, where they put forward the theory that he is a warlock himself, and that the dog is a familiar. It was a kind of white witch that turned herself into a dog and gave him powers, like, or just sort of gave him the power of indestructibility. There are other powers, like it could turn invisible, could sniff out treasure, it could detect traitors, it could fly, and it could literally swallow musket balls that were fired at him, which was categorically disproved when he got shot dead at the Battle of Marston Moor. The dog, that is, not Prince Rupert. Yeah, so Prince Rupert is the most famous casualty of Marston Moor. And when we do anything to do with Prince Rupert with school groups, they couldn't give a monkeys about the 4,000 people killed at Marston Moor. But when you mentioned the dog died, it's like people just lose their, yeah.
I'm still not over it.
From there. Yeah.
It's still fresh to me.
Yeah, but he's a vicious dog. He just loved fighting. He was like the dog equivalent of his master. So so there is a school of thought, you know, that once you remove that, he starts to lose. But I don't know. I'll just leave that one hanging, just to whether that's true or not.
I know exactly what you mean, because whenever we do the battlefields, we talk about thousands of men being killed, you know, and then all of a sudden a leftover mine explodes in the 1950s and kills a cow, and your entire group goes, oh.
Horses as well. I mean, the Civil War is rough on horses. It really is. And weirdly enough, like, cavalry soldiers didn't seem to have the same sentimental attachments to their horses, because they went through them like underpants, you know. And it was just, And so, but yeah, people get upset about, you know, the deaths of horses more than they do about the deaths of people. But you know, horses didn't ask to be war horses, did they? But I think Rupert's dog was aggressive by nature and loved to fight.
Right, let's go move things on a little bit. What was Rupert's relationship with Charles, the King in Exile? Because I mean, he came back to England at the Restoration.
Yeah,
didn't he? So was he part of the court, and how were things?
He was part of the court. I think he was always loyal. He was loyal to Charles the First, even though he fell out with it. He was always loyal to Charles the Second and James the Duke of York. Even when he disagreed with them, and he did disagree with them, and they had fallings out, they reconciled, but there was always that thread that sort of tied them together. It's interesting with Charles II, because Charles II looked up to Rupert because Rupert was older at a certain point, but then when he became king, obviously he had to be king. And so there's this shift in sort of power, obviously, and shift in adoration, you know, because he's not looking up to his elder cousin anymore. He's the king. And Rupert, although he's his cousin, has certain liberties, is his subordinate and needs to obey him. And they had a testy relationship in exile, because all the royals ended up in Saint-Germain, you know, being sort of, you know, basically the kind of guests of the French royal family, because just to complicate like the family trees even more, Rupert's aunt was Queen Henrietta Maria, who I think was a sister of Louis XIV. And so they're there, but they're not really welcome guests, it has to be said, because they're constantly falling out, fighting each other. Rupert, the moment he sort of gets back to Saint-Germain after the wars, he finds Digby, who's betrayed him, tries to fight a duel, tries to kill him in a duel. But Henrietta Maria intervenes, not allowed to do that. And I think his relationship with Rupert was the most strained before the Restoration, when during the Second Civil War, when fighting resumes, when King Charles is a prisoner of the Roundheads, but still manages to start a war from his prison cell. Rupert's contribution is to, command a small fleet. When I say small, about 8 ships, and basically sort of try and plunder parliamentarian shipping, kind of around the Mediterranean, Portuguese coast. And this is a disastrous mission. He never really kind of accrues any sort of wealth for the king, because he's dogged and pursued by the parliamentarian navy, which is actually quite capable, and led by this man, I think it's kind of Robert Blake, who's a great sort of admiral at the time, and he's sort of hounded into the North Atlantic, and then he's beset by 2 storms, one of which sinks his sort of flagship, if you like, drowns 330 of his men, and all the money that they've accrued goes to the bottom of the ocean. And then there's a second storm later that sinks another ship and drowns his brother. And we talk about the relationship between like Rupert and his dog, but the real fundamental relationship is between him and his brother, Prince Maurice. And so the drowning of his brother really kind of affects him in a way that I think even the death of his uncle didn't. And he sort of limps back into port with 2 ships, a little bit of money, and they literally have to sell the cannons on their boats to kind of scrape together. And to be honest, like Charles II, as he is in exile, was disgusted with this, and it created a bit of distance between the two, which is largely forgiven and forgotten when Charles comes back and there's the Restoration and Rupert sort of follows him, and they're sort of fairly tight for a while, I think, there are no wars being fought that will come, Rupert sort of tends to devote himself to sort of scientific endeavor. He's one of the founder members of the Royal Society. He's the 3rd founder member. And the king has that honeymoon period.
Yeah.
And, Rupert and the king are getting on pretty well. But that bond would never break. Rupert's always going to be loyal. He's always going to put his own considerations. He'll say what he thinks, but he'll always knuckle under and obey his king. So that's Rupert. I mean, he's fanatically loyal to the royal line.
And he lives a decent life, doesn't he, in the Restoration? He becomes an admiral as well as being this kind of polymath.
Yeah.
Genius.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a pretty good admiral as well. And that's the part. I mean, he fights the Dutch in the Second and Third Anglo-Dutch Wars, which England lose. But that's not necessarily his fault. And, if you sort of ranking him against great commanders, he's no match for Cromwell. He's chased out of, he's chased into the North Atlantic by Robert Blake. But he actually managed at one point to defeat, my pronunciation is probably awful, but Admiral de Ruyter, I think that's probably,
yeah, that's right.
any Dutch listeners, please forgive my mispronunciation.
That's how we say it. We say de Ruyter.
Yeah. but he even manages to defeat him. And this man is considered one of the greatest admirals, in sort of maritime martial history, and even defeats him in a battle called the St. James's Day Battle, and so he's a good sea admiral. He's a terrific scientist, still not a politician, still upsets people, things like that. But I think the Restoration was kind of a good time for him on many levels, but he's still, hankering after his homeland. He doesn't really get the money or the lands that he wants, even when the 30 Years' War is over, because his elder brother Charles Lewis doesn't like him and sort of blocks him a little bit, and so I think he lives on many levels according to his own sort of military standards and his own sort of standards of kind of where his family should be and the sort of political landscape of Europe. He lives a frustrated life until the very end, when he knows he's too old to fight, and he's not going to get these things. And then he achieves a sort of contentment in his sort of later years. But yeah, I mean, certainly by the standards of the time, if you can, you know, for a soldier in Restoration England, I would say he was a reasonably decent man, and probably less, you know, he wasn't given to the kind of profligate nature of the age in the way that a lot of others were, especially his cousin, the king. You know, he wasn't Charles II with kind of revolving doors, you know, in his bedroom and things like that, you know.
But he's good with the ladies. He is good with the ladies, our Prince Rupert.
This is an interesting one for Freudians. He's good with the ladies when he's not fighting. That's the interesting thing. When he's engaged in war, he has no interest. You know, he's good with the ladies in peacetime. So the first sort of significant romance is when he's a prisoner in Lintz Castle. He's got nothing to do, you know, because his prison's lovely. I mean, I wouldn't mind being like a sort of prisoner of war if you get a whole castle to yourself. You get access to this lovely library. You get a tennis court. He's a very good tennis player, by the way. And then you have this absolutely beautiful Catholic German daughter of the jailer interested in you with a sort of tacit consent of a dad. You know, so that was the first. And then you know, like the other two significant sort of loves of his life are Frances Bard, and forgive me, I can't remember when he kind of hooks up with her, but her father, Henry Bard, was a soldier that he fought with. I mean, her father, Henry Bard, I only learned this the other day. He was a one-armed man who was I mean, you've got to mitigate this about the fact that it was the sacking of Leicester, but he was the first up the scaling ladders as a one-armed man at the siege of Leicester. And so he sort of grew up, you know, I mean, he you know, Rupert knew Henry Bard, knew his daughter, and then sort of had a child with Frances Bard, and then kind of cruelly chucks her over for an actress. So it's the Restoration cliche, ends up with an actress called Peg Hughes, and that's the sort of last love of his life. And he has a daughter called Ruperta, and then sort of, you know, looks after, makes sure that she's well provisioned. But she's got massive gambling problems. So any money he leaves her, she sort of fritters away. But you know, Frances Bard's looked after by Rupert's sister. I mean, Rupert's sister was very fond of Frances Bard and her son Dudley, and so she becomes a lady in waiting and gets a pension from Rupert's sister, effectively. You know, but she always claimed that she married him, and there's no evidence. You know, so they married secretly, but there's no evidence to suggest that they actually did.
Well, we're kind of running out of time. We sort of got to the end of his life just about there, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, did he have a death that was in any way interesting?
It depends if you find like pleurisy and the collapsing of the lungs interesting. Oh. I mean, I think it's fair to say no one has a nice death in Restoration England, because if war doesn't finish you off, some horrible disease does, however rich you are. Oh, can I just talk about that? I mean, if you want evidence of the fact that the embargo on being wounded was lifted after the death of the dog.
Yeah.
He did start to accumulate injuries, right, in every subsequent war. He was, as a pirate, he was shot in the chest with an arrow, like when he was in the Caribbean, I think it was. Cut the wound out with a knife. He caught malaria and sort of he just dabbled a little bit in fighting the Spanish for the King of France and got shot in the head. So he was shot in the head, and in typical Rupert fashion, just kind of, you know, got patched up and just shrugged it off. And what he found out was he got depressed fractures, but it knocked a bit of his skull in, and the wound got worse, progressively worse. And so when he was fighting his incredible bloody violent naval battles in the Dutch War, he started to suffer these incredible headaches and still commanded ships, essentially with this bit of bone pressing on his brain. That should have killed him.
Yeah.
And the way to fix it was an old-fashioned trepanning operation, basically, where they shave his head, drill into his skull, remove the bit of skull, completely without anaesthetic, people holding him down. And then the first trepanning operation is a disaster. So what's the remedy for a bad trepanning operation? Another trepanning operation. So he has it done twice. So he's like a twice drilled man. He survives all of that and then dies of pleurisy, like at age 65. So by the standards of the time, it was a good death. You're going to die of something.
And that's,
I think he might have preferred to be killed in battle, but yeah.
Yeah, 65 is a very decent age. Especially for a soldier. So my goodness,
with a young actress as your lady as well. You know,
I mean,
living in Windsor Castle, you know, with your own little laboratory.
There is nothing more restoration than this. You've got your lab, you're in a castle, you've got an actress. I mean, he's clearly a cousin of the king in every sense. Adam, thank you so much for joining us and for potting, condensing this incredible man. We clearly don't have enough time to talk on everything. Yeah. Where can our listeners find you to find out more?
Well, via the National Civil War Centre, they've got a website. I'm not a massive social media person, but on Facebook, if you want to find out what I'm up to in terms of mine and my brother's, and occasionally my dad's sort of like ventures into sort of historic, the Fighting Nightingales, that's Nightingale with an N, not a K, Fighting Nightingales Facebook page, I think on Acast and through the National Civil War Centre Learning Space, and on YouTube, there's my podcast series I did over lockdown called 17th Century Tales. It's got a couple of episodes on Rupert, but he kind of pops up periodically. And the jumping off point is like Civil War in the East Midlands, specifically Nottinghamshire, but we branch off and talk about everything and some books on Amazon under my name.
Amazing. You yourself are a polymath, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. And Lockie, thank you for joining me in a 17th century war fest.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you. It was very, 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 very pleasurable. Thank you.